First rule of Blagojevich: select your product.
Governor Blagojevich tried to sell the appointment to the Senate seat vacated by President-elect Obama.
Rule number two, set your price.
Governor Blagojevich wanted a number of things in exchange for making the appointment to the Senate seat. An appointment as Secretary of Health and Human Services, or an ambassadorship, an appointment to a private foundation, a higher paying job for his wife, or campaign contributions.
Sounds easy enough. Where do I sign? It's a special broadcast Illinois State House fiasco takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, December 10th, and I just for the record need to say that guess what? The governor of Illinois, he is still innocent until proven guilty.
Yeah, it's probably nothing. Good morning, Adora.
Today, though, we are going to take a hard look at the stunning allegations facing Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. We're also going to take a look at the riots in Greece on day five and the many ways to prepare a very cheap lobster. Those stories are coming up. First, these headlines.
Prosecutors say President-elect Barack Obama is not suspected of any wrongdoing connected to the Blagojevich probe, but this revolves around the Senate seat he held, so he had to respond yesterday.
It's a sad day for Illinois. Beyond that, I don't think it's appropriate to comment.
Charges are also a headache for Senate Democrats. They don't want the next senator from Illinois tainted by the scandal. They're pushing Illinois to fill the seat by special election rather than the governor's appointment. In the past, politicians denying wrongdoing or various forms of monkey business have not fared well after daring people to monitor them. But that's apparently a hard lesson to learn. Here's Governor Blagojevich before the arrest.
If anybody wants to tape my conversations, go right ahead. Feel free to do it. I appreciate anybody who wants to tape me openly and notoriously.
Veteran Illinois political reporter and takeaway pal Ben Calhoun will be with us in a moment to look at all the angles of this story.
As for politics on Capitol Hill, it appears the White House and congressional Democrats are basically on the same page for a $15 billion loan package for car makers. They hope to finalize and vote on it today. However, a group of conservative senators is not convinced, so it could be a tough road for the measure. Overseas, Pakistan says it has two alleged top planners of the Mumbai attacks in custody. India has asked Pakistan to turn over high-ranking terror suspects, but Pakistan prefers to interrogate them on its own soil.
Six Afghan police are dead after mistaken identity led to a firefight with American troops. Officials say the police fired on the Americans by mistake. The gunfight wounded 13.
A key American ally in Iraq is pulling out. The United Kingdom has one of the largest troop presences there. Now they're announcing a withdrawal starting in March. Most British troops will be gone by June. That's an interesting development.
Yes, indeed. The situation in Greece, which we've also been following, is intensifying. New developments in a controversial police shooting case. Today, there's a general strike by unions to protest economic hardship. The Dow was down nearly 3% yesterday to close at 86.91. The S&P begins trading today at 8.88, and the futures are up, although it's vaguely up but flat this morning. If Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich was arrested yesterday morning on public corruption charges, and they stick, you know, how shocked are you? What should his punishment be? And what would you sell if you had one of those fabulous superpowers, like you could appoint anyone and you had the absolute power to do it? What would you do with that power? What would you sell? 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTake at TheTakeAway.org. We're trying to get into the mind of Blagojevich.
It's a bleeping valuable thing.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I think the Illinois General Assembly should enact a law as quickly as possible calling for a special election to fill the Senate vacancy of Barack Obama. No appointment by this governor under these circumstances could produce a credible replacement.
Good morning. That's Illinois Senator Dick Durbin, the remaining senator in Illinois, reacting to the tremendous allegations and developments of yesterday as Governor Blagojevich is arrested and accused of corruption, including offering for sale the Senate seat of Barack Obama, which he has the right to actually appoint constitutionally under the Illinois Constitution. Joining us now is Ben Calhoun, political reporter for Chicago Public Radio and our friend contributor here at The Takeaway. Ben, thanks for joining us.
You know, thanks for having me.
In watching the news conference yesterday and the various reactions to what went on, I mean, if Al Capone had come back from the dead, it couldn't have been more shocking than these Blagojevich allegations. First of all, before we get to the reaction, what are the details that we know and how long was this coming?
This is part of a federal investigation that was nicknamed Operation Board Games, and it had been building for about 5 years. The circle had been closing in around the governor. There wasn't a lot of shock because of that. I think that the nature of the allegations, though, it's only a two-count indictment, but the sweeping array of behavior that's included in the criminal complaint, the supposed auctioning of the Senate seat, deals involving the Cubs, taking money back from a children's hospital. You know, it takes a lot to shock Illinoisans when it comes to corruption. But I talked to, you know, the most veteran observers yesterday. People were using terms like unbelievable, beyond comprehension, stunning, speechless. You know, I think that, Patrick Fitzgerald, the U.S. attorney, is a very calm, cool, collected guy. He's not prone to hyperbole, but I think we've got a piece of tape here that sort of speaks to how taken aback everybody who was looking at these allegations yesterday was, and this is what he said.
But the most cynical behavior in all this, the most appalling, is the fact that Governor Blagojevich tried to sell the appointment to the Senate seat vacated by President-elect Obama. The conduct would make Lincoln roll over in his grave. The governor's own words describing the Senate seat, quote, "It's a bleeping valuable thing. You just don't give it away for nothing," close quote.
And Ben, well, we're bleeping glad to have you with us this morning. And, you know, the 76-page complaint tells this amazing story that we were sharing yesterday here in the Takeaway offices, that basically based on this long-term investigation, it became clear to Fitzgerald that they needed to bug his phones because he was going to do the same kind of shakedown on the Senate seat as he was doing on this Children's Hospital and the Tribune and the other things. It's an amazing sort of culmination.
Exactly. You know, if you go back to other cases that Patrick Fitzgerald has brought in press conferences, he'll often say, we bring these cases when they're ready. He made very clear yesterday, because the question for me and all my colleagues was, why do this now? You know, why is now the time to act? And he said, this was a crime spree on the verge of happening. He talked about the Senate appointment. He talked about millions of dollars in funding for Children's Memorial Hospital on Chicago's north side that was being threatened with having money taken away.
$8 million.
$8 million. There was pressure being put on the Chicago Tribune to get rid of members of its editorial board in order to grease the rails for their deal involving the Cubs and Wrigley Field. And he just said because all of these things were immediately impending, they felt like they had to act and blow this up right now.
Clearly, there was some urgency. Anytime federal officials are arresting someone on white-collar charges at 6 o'clock in the morning, you know something's up. But the depth of the greed is what seems to be so shocking. The systematic way with which the prosecutors are alleging the governor acted, and it clearly, Ben, brings into question so many decisions that the governor made while he was in office.
It does. What's really stunning is that a lot of the things that you'll see here, the quotes that prosecutors have in the criminal complaint from the governor, these all took place within the last 3 months. This is an investigation that has been inching its way towards the governor and has hit some of his close friends and advisors, probably most notably Tony Rezko, his friend and political fundraiser who came up during the presidential campaign. But it isn't as if he didn't know this was going on. At one point, prosecutors quote him in the criminal complaint as saying to an aide, do your business as if the whole world is listening. And he's saying this. Well, he's bugged. I mean, people were listening, and they were federal investigators, and it's detailed in the complaint. But the fact that he says the things that he said as recently as he said them are kind of beyond belief.
And he even said it publicly, that he didn't care if he was being recorded, that he didn't
have— just the other day.
He said, you want to record me? Go anything, ahead. That he didn't have anything to hide.
Well, is it possible, Ben, that it's okay to talk about corrupt stuff if no money changes hands? I mean, Fitzgerald really, it seems like, has a lot of tapes of Blagojevich talking a lot of crazy stuff, but I'm wondering if that constitutes a felony, just the talking.
You mean just the conversations
about it? Right.
Well, he establishes, allegedly establishes, according to a lot of the quotes that we see, a quid pro quo. Trying to get something, some kind of personal gain, whether contributions to his campaign fund or a job for him or his wife in exchange for political favors. And that was where Fitzgerald said it crosses the line from, you know, just your standard political horse trading to criminal behavior.
Is Blagojevich a beloved figure in Illinois in some sense? I mean, you've already got a governor in prison, Governor Ryan. I mean, he came in on an anti-corruption platform and really has taken the cake here.
He did. He ran on reform. He ran on reform in 2002. The thing that's really unbelievable, I have to say, about Blagojevich is just the way that he has reacted in the face of the investigation. There's this dissonance between his response and what's going on around him. He had a 13% approval rating, according to a recent poll. Another poll put it at 15%. So between the two, I guess we can average them to 14% approval rating. And that was before yesterday. He is by no means beloved. And
Ben, he still is the governor. And technically, he still has the ability to appoint someone to Barack Obama's Senate seat. What is being done to address that? Because clearly politicians in the state can't be pleased with that notion.
Yeah, he does. According to the Illinois Constitution, he is the sitting governor with all of the privileges and power that comes with that.
And an arrest doesn't take that away.
Nope, does not.
Wow. So he could call up his neighbor and make him senator. He could call you up. He can name himself senator.
I think that anybody who accepts an appointment from Governor Blagojevich is going to have a bit of a shadow hanging over them. But he could theoretically do that. And Illinois Senator Dick Durbin yesterday immediately put out the call that the state legislatures take that decision away from the governor, which has gone into the works. They're talking about a special session to put together some veto-proof majorities and, regardless of what the governor does in terms of vetoes, just take that decision out of his control.
And Lieutenant Governor Pat Quinn is calling on Blagojevich to step down. Listen.
I recommend to the governor to realize what he really does know already, and that is he cannot carry out his responsibilities of office today, and he should, in my opinion, step aside.
What are the obstacles to Blagojevich stepping down, aside from his own personality, and what are the difficulties in assembling a special election that's going to be credible?
Well, we've got a chorus of by the end of yesterday afternoon, we had every single one of the state's constitutional officers, treasurer, secretary of state, comptroller, every single one of them was calling for his resignation. But I can't overstate the size of the obstacle that is Blagojevich's personality in this case. You know, his defiance in response to this federal investigation, even just the conversations that he's quoted in the criminal complaint as having, I think show a certain defiance and disconnect. A reporter in Springfield named Rich Miller recently described him as I asked him to describe the governor to people out of state, and he said, I don't know if I could. You know, some people describe him as crazy. I wouldn't go that far, but maybe that's the best description.
Well, the wheels are turning there in Illinois, but it sounds like Blagojevich still has some cards to play. We'll be watching today. Ben Calhoun, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, guys.
Ben Calhoun is a political reporter for Chicago Public Radio and our friend.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. We're going to head over to Greece, where for a fifth day, hundreds of demonstrators have been clashing with police, many railing against the shooting death by police of a teenager. Also today, union workers went on strike, and as a result of both, flights in and out of Athens Airport have been canceled, and public transportation has been badly disrupted. We go now to Sarah Rainsford, a BBC correspondent who is currently in Athens. Welcome, Sarah. And I understand the two police officers accused of shooting the teenage boy were actually in court today, and that triggered another round of clashes.
Certainly, those two police officers who've been charged, we did get some news from their lawyers today. One of the lawyers for one of the policemen charged claims that a ballistics report into the bullet that was fired and that killed the 15-year-old boy on Saturday, which sparked this whole wave of violence. He said that ballistics report suggests that the bullet was not fired directly by the policeman at the teenager, but that it ricocheted off, that it was a warning shot fired by the policeman and accidentally killing the boy. Now, that has not been confirmed by the authorities here in Greece, but it's unlikely, I think, really to sort of quell the anger that's been shown on the streets here, demonstrated on the streets here for the last four nights. There is a very angry mood in Greece, across Greece, particularly here in Athens, where people believe that the police really overstepped the mark, and they're angry too at the government for being unable to stop the to keep the police in line and then to police the demonstrations properly that have erupted as a result. So, yes, news from the ballistics report, but I think probably the unrest will continue to some extent here in Greece.
And in part that's because this latest clash is really part of an ongoing number of clashes that have taken place, some say, over the last 40 years between police and this basic mistrust that many in Greece have of them.
True, and also I think it's an expression of a real dissatisfaction with the current government. I mean, what happened today was that thousands of trades union members came out onto the streets. There's a general strike, as you mentioned. That's caused widespread disruption to transport and to businesses here in Greece. Those union members came out on the streets to stage a peaceful protest. Now, that was something that the government asked them to cancel because of security reasons, saying they were worried it could degenerate into violence. The union members said, no way. This is our right to peaceful protest. We're unhappy at the government's economic policies, at the rising poverty in this country, the high unemployment, the fact that children here don't believe that when they grow up they'll get jobs, and they want something to change. So they staged that protest, and for the most part it was peaceful. Thousands and thousands of people passed by Parliament chanting slogans against the government and calling for change, but there was a hardcore of anarchist protesters, some student protesters, some very young people who then started throwing stones at police, throwing bottles at police and a couple of bottle bombs, and the police responded with some tear gas. But it was fairly calm. It was nothing like the real trouble that we've seen over the past few days here. So perhaps a suggestion that things are starting to calm down.
But Sarah, it certainly puts in a lot of pressure on a ruling party that is just ruling by a very thin majority in Parliament, and elections are not far off.
It is a huge amount of pressure on this government. They've actually just had elections last year. So in theory, in normal circumstances, there'd be a while to go till the next one. But the opposition leader here is trying to capitalize on the growing unrest and the growing dissatisfaction with the government, calling for early elections. Now, the Prime Minister's resisting that. He is saying that, of course, the killing of the teenage boy was a tragedy, that that should never be repeated, but that people shouldn't try to make political gains from this, and that the vandalism and the violence that we've seen here for the past few days has to stop. Now, the current sort of analysis seems to be that he is clinging on by the skin of his teeth, and he could continue to do that if he continues with his current strategy, that the governing party, although it has a very slim majority in Parliament, could survive this. But certainly, if it does, I think it'll be a bit of a lame duck government, because the opposition across the country has been very forcibly expressed. Those pictures from those demonstrations obviously have been played out across the country, and that will only reflect badly on this government.
And what's interesting, actually, is that some of the looting and the violence may have actually helped the ruling party, in that those who, it seems to be no question that generally people are unhappy with the government, but there are also a lot of people who are very unhappy with the looting and the violence.
Certainly with the violence, yes, and of course the looting. There are people who are not happy at all that some perhaps anarchist groups, some hardcore left-wing activists have been using the opportunity to run riot, literally, in the streets of some cities here in Greece. But there is still a lot of support for the expression of anger in a peaceful way, you know, for the mass protests that there have been here. And people understand, you know, how that's spilling out into violent protests in some instances. You know, there's a long history in Greece, because of the military dictatorship that there was here until 1974, there's a lot of support for the right to protest, for democratic freedoms. And people cling very, very firmly to those democratic freedoms, which, of course, are only, you know, 30 or so years old. So that right to peaceful protest is widely supported. The violence, however, as you quite rightly say, is not supported by a lot of people. And people have been scared by the scenes that they've seen.
Sarah Rainsford, many thanks. Sarah Rainsford is a BBC correspondent, and she was reporting from Athens, Greece, where clashes continue between law enforcement and people on the street.
It's hard to separate what the sort of contemporary political tension is in Greece right now from the tradition of kind of anarchist protest and the split that exists between the students in Greece, who have always been pretty radical, and the, you know, compromised political establishment there.
It just seems more widespread, particularly when you have on this day unions striking, unhappy about the economic policies. I mean, obviously they're not running rampant in the streets, but they are demonstrating, as Sarah pointed out, and exercising that right to protest against the government.
Well, not to diminish one death, but it does seem like a relatively small event to produce this national crisis. And now, headlines from Femi Oke.
Thank you. Good morning. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. Negotiations are set to resume today in Chicago, where laid-off workers have occupied a factory floor in protest. Yesterday, Bank of America said they will provide loans to the factory, and this is so that it can pay severance and vacation pay. Workers say the protest will continue until the deal is finalized. A second alleged planner of the Mumbai attacks has been detained in Pakistan. Zara Shah is said to be a member of Lashkar-e-Taiba, the banned Pakistani militant group blamed for this and other attacks. The Mumbai attacks killed more than 170 people. China has reported a fall in exports for the first time in 7 years. It's the clearest sign yet of the downturn affecting its economy. They dropped by more than 2%, that's exports in China, in November over the same period from last year. And the document credited with starting the global human rights movement turns 60 today. It's the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The UN document outlines the rights and freedoms of all people, and it has become a bedrock of international law, and it's also the most translated document in the world. That's a look at some of the stories making news this morning.
Thanks, Femi.
Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age. Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I hate to say it, but it's inescapable. Rod Blagojevich, the governor of Illinois, got us thinking. If a Senate seat, according to the allegation in the complaint in Illinois, is worth about $500,000 to Rod Blagojevich, if you were in power, what would you sell a Senate seat for? Not for yourself, but to raise money for the government. We're in debt, right? We need to raise money. We need to sell a lot of stuff. So what would you sell in the government? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. The Capitol, the Pentagon, the Dome, the parking lots, the government printing office, the fighter jets.
You're looking at me like, yeah. I would know. I'm
price
thinking
tax,
like everyone
for.
Else who's hearing yes. your question. Yes. What would I sell? Mm, the fleet of cars?
877-8-MY-TAKE. Government has a lot of stuff and it needs a lot of money. Help us out here. Join the conversation. So joining us here in the studio is our friend Melissa Clark, New York Times food writer, who got the idea to take a look at the economic one of the consequences of the economic crisis for food writers by listening to our program, where we learned, actually, in the studio, Dora.
Indeed.
That lobsters in this particular moment in time, for a whole variety of reasons, the economy is one of them, but not the only one, are cheap these days. Cheaper
Very
than they've been in a
ever.
Quarter century.
And the catches are larger and more fruitful right. than they've been in decades.
Tons of lobsters selling for less than they have in a quarter century, which gave Melissa Clark some ideas. Melissa, thanks for joining us.
Ah, thanks for having me. Well, first of all, how often is it that you get to go out, buy lobsters, take them home and think, you know, I can actually do whatever I want with these. As a cook, normally when I buy a lobster, I just want to steam it. I want to be as conservative as possible because I've spent a lot of money on this thing. Put it on the table with a little melted butter and that's it. But this time, with the lobster prices the way they are, I thought, okay, the creative cook in me is going to really come out and have some fun. And that's what I did. And I did four lobster recipes, which are on your website, and I had the best time with them.
Now, are lobsters extremely labor-intensive? Lots of cutting, pasting, ripping, pulling,
don't
that
paste
kind of
them.
Thing?
That would be a bad idea. Well, the hardest thing about a lobster, and this is the part that I think you might get some letters about, is before you cook them, you actually have to kill them. You either because you buy them and they're alive when you buy them, and there's just no way to get around that fact.
And you asked for some advice on the very best way to kill a lobster, and it's a little disturbing, but explain.
I know. Well, you know, for years I had done it the way I learned how to do it, which is to take the live lobster and to just put it in the pot of boiling water. And apparently this is a very bad way to kill lobsters because they're alive in there for about a minute, which is way too long time to be in boiling water. But that's just how I had been taught to do it. But when I heard your guest, who is Trevor Corson, who had written a book, The Secret Life of Lobsters, right. I called him up and I said, there's got to be a better way. And this is what you do. You put them in the freezer first because it slows their metabolism down. And that way they're going to... It acts as kind
it's
of a
kind of like
numbs
a lethal
them.
Injection.
It numbs
it's
them.
Like a Valium or something.
Exactly. And then you take them in your hand, put them on the counter, shell side down so their underbellies are exposed. Take the sharpest knife you have. Do this as quickly as possible, and just cut them in there through right down the center. And that
I'm
will
sorry.
That'll get them immediately.
Cuts the nerves. All right, well, we spent a minute now talking
so
about
you're
death
stabbing
and
the lobster
killing.
Before you boil them?
You are. I know. It sounds like, why would you do that? But it actually is the most humane and quickest way to kill your lobster. And that's what you want. You
so
really
we're
going to
impale the lobster.
We're going to impale the lobster. This is, and a lot of people, you've heard, probably heard to get them between the eyes. I know chefs like to take a lobster, put them facing you and get them between the eyes, but apparently that's not as quick right. a method as getting them in
well,
the center.
I don't want to eat lobster.
guys,
lobster is.
You know, before PETA shows up here
yeah,
in our
exactly.
studios, could we get to some recipes here?
Absolutely.
All right. So, obviously, there's the right out of the shell lobster tail kind of dish.
Right.
But what were the more fancy things that you decided to do? Elaborate.
Well, you know,
exotic.
When I was thinking about what to do with lobster, I was thinking shrimp because texturally they're very similar. They have that succulent, meaty quality to them. So I was thinking about some of the great shrimp recipes that I had done. And one of my favorite things to do is to put shrimp in over pasta with a little cream sauce. So I thought, why don't I do that with lobster? And the flavor would be even more intense and sweeter. And it was so good. I took egg pasta, really soft, fresh egg pasta, and I boiled it. And while it was on the stove, I just sauteed the lobster meat, which has been cooked as we described, with sherry and a whipped egg yolks. And what the egg yolks do is it creates a cream sauce that's much lighter than using heavy cream. Mm. It's like a sabayon almost. And you put that on top of the cream pasta with a little tarragon. And then this was the best part, salmon caviar, just a few little beads. And it was
good.
So
sounds
delicious.
Good.
And anyone listening can do this with shrimp as well if you don't want to deal
with
lobster.
Do you always deal with cooked, already steamed, boiled lobster? Or do you ever use it raw? Do you ever saute it raw or grill it or anything like that?
Well, the thing about lobster, you can do it raw. It's harder to get it out of the shell. I mean, once you've actually, you know, you've as we described, killed your lobster. Then you have to take it apart. It's hard to get that claw meat out, and it's hard to get you just basically end up with a tail, although you can do it. I find it easier to steam it first.
So,
and by the way, listeners, you can actually have your lobster steamed for you at your fish store and bring it home steamed. So just so you know.
So what else? You came up with a couple of other
things. Yeah, this one was really fun. Have you ever had a twice-baked potato?
Sure.
Well, I had learned how to do one with shrimp in it, and it was so good I did it with lobster. Can you imagine? This was the most delicious thing. You take your potato, you bake it, scoop out the insides, mash it up with a little sour cream or mayonnaise or butter or whatever you want to make it rich. Put your lobster in, back in the oven with some cheese on top and a little bit of chives. So
that sounds
special.
Great.
That does
that
sound great. Good.
Now, what do you not want to do with lobster?
Like, you don't want to overcook your lobster.
No,
you
don't
want it to be
it.
Rubbery. You really want to make sure that you pull it out. The second it's bright red, you'll see that it goes from kind of purple to bright red.
And spices that don't work with lobster, things that you want
anything
to avoid?
Anything overpowering. I did another recipe that had soy sauce and sesame oil in it. It was Asian-inspired with beautiful oyster mushrooms because, you know, lobster oysters.
Yeah.
And the first time I did it, I used a little too much sesame oil and soy sauce. These are intense flavors. You really want to dial them back. You want to be really simple with your lobster. Just a dash here, a drop there, and it was gorgeous.
Melissa Clark, New York Times food writer, thank you very much. Cheap lobsters,
twice,
a revelation.
Twice baked potatoes. I'm going to have to try that.
And headlines from Femi. Okay, there's a headline. I was stunned by just...
Well, our heads were in the kitchen
Transfixed.
Somewhere. Right,
Transfixed.
There you go.
You're fantasizing about food. I can understand that. 20 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning. This morning on Wall Street, investors seem optimistic that Congress will approve $15 billion for automakers. Stock futures point to a slightly higher opening. The White House and Democrats have agreed in principle on aid that would speed loans to Detroit's struggling car companies. A group of Republicans has threatened to oppose the deal. New developments in the shooting death of a teenager in Greece that sparked the country's worst rioting in decades. Two police officers faced charges in the killing, one with murder. And now the lawyer for the police officers say that the boy died from a ricochet shot. He claims this backs up the police story that they were firing warning shots. Pakistan's prime minister says that a second alleged mastermind behind the terror attacks in Mumbai, India, has been arrested. He's believed to be connected to a banned Pakistani militant group blamed for that attack and others in India. The Hajj pilgrimage ends today. Some 3 million Muslims went to Mecca to fulfill one of the five pillars of Islam. Every Muslim who is healthy and has the money is expected to go at least once in their lives. And Saudi authorities have invested huge amounts of money to protect visitors on this last day and during the entire Hajj pilgrimage. And that's a look at some of the stories making news this morning.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Huckenberry. And until yesterday morning and the arrest of Governor Rod Blagojevich of Illinois, it was the big story in Chicago. Joining us now is Raul Flores, who's an 8-year employee of Chicago's Republic Windows and Doors Company. In the middle of that factory is a sit-in where workers have been demanding back pay and vacation pay when they were told they had 3 days' notice to leave the factory. And the unpaid bills produced this labor action that's still going on. Raul, thanks for joining us.
Thank you guys for having me, and thanks for all your support.
Now, the governor was trying to mediate this crisis until he got tangled up in his own big mess. What are the state of the negotiations between the company, the union, and apparently Bank of America, which has a credit line that it withdrew from Republic Windows and Doors that precipitated all of this?
Well, we're still talking. Yesterday, we came to the factory at 10 p.m. We talked to the workers, and today we're going to continue talking, you know, to them. And until we have something written down, if we agree, we're going to sign up. And if we don't, we go back and keep talking to them.
Now, how much money are you personally owed, and how much money do you think is at stake if you add up all of the workers' unpaid invoices?
Well, personally, they owe me 3 weeks of vacation. My last paycheck, and those 60 days are the last phase, you know, the warm-up.
So that's thousands of dollars leading into the holidays. That's not insignificant.
Well, yeah, it's a lot of money. And I think it's fair that they keep our money. We already earned that money. That belongs to us.
Raul, why does the bank owe you money if they looked at the company and said, look, you're failing. We're not going to lend you any more money. Isn't it the company's responsibility to pay you, not the bank?
Well, personally, we don't know whose responsibility is, but somebody got to take responsibility of this. Somebody got to put their face. Somebody got to take care of this situation. And another thing, Bank of America, they get billions of dollars out of our pockets, out of your taxes, out of my taxes, and basically we're paying them to get us fired.
So the fact that they're in the bailout makes you pretty mad, and it's not so much that you think the bank owes you money. It's just it can't be the case that nobody owes you this money. That's unacceptable.
Well, yes, that's our money. You know, that's what the money, that's what the federal government give them the money for, to keep their jobs going. And the only thing that they're doing is using them for themselves. They're buying more places. They just bought a LaSalle. You know, they're expanding themselves.
LaSalle National Bank, right? They own Countrywide Mortgage. They're the largest bank in the world, or in the United States. Raul, do you think at the end of this crisis that your jobs will go away at Republic and that the company will be finished?
Well, we don't know yet. But if we got to keep working, we're going to keep working. That's what we're here for. We're here to work, and we're ready for work.
All right. Well, it's possible that the final details will be nailed down today, and there could be a settlement today. You're still talking. Raul Flores, thanks so much for joining us, an eight-year employee of Chicago's Republic Windows and Doors Company at the sit-in that's still going on. Raul, thanks for joining us, and good luck this holiday season.
Thank you, guys, and thanks for all your support.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. On this Wednesday, December 10th, we want to get you caught up on all the latest headlines, and that's why Femi Okeh has just joined us.
Hello there. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. U.S. Special Forces have accidentally killed six Afghan police officers and wounded at least 13 others. Officials say the police fired on the Americans, mistaking them for Taliban fighters. British troops are pulling out of Iraq. The UK force is one of the largest in the country, and now they're announcing a pullout starting in March. Most British troops will be gone by June of next year. The UK has about 4,000 troops in southern Iraq, and at the height of the invasion in 2003, there were about 40,000 Britons fighting there. Many of the troops from Iraq will be sent to fight in Afghanistan. Illinois Governor Rob Blagojevich says that he's going back to work today. The governor is charged with corruption after alleging attempting to sell the Senate seat vacated by President-elect Barack Obama. Now, in a press conference discussing the governor's case, FBI Special Agent Robert Grant brought up Illinois' reputation for crime.
I can tell you one thing. If it isn't the most corrupt state in the United States, it's certainly one hell of a competitor.
I wonder what this day is going to look like for the governor. Just thinking out loud.
Yeah.
Meeting with some Boy Scouts. Yeah, you know, the usual thing.
Working out the plan for what to do next, perhaps.
Selling the state capitol.
How much work can he actually get done?
I think he might be a little bit distracted.
Sell Lake Michigan?
Yeah.
Probably get a lot for that.
It's a bleeping valuable thing.
Yeah, sure.
There's been so much bleeping on the show this morning. I'm outraged. Okay, can I continue?
One more, and then we got to go.
Girls and boy. Today is also a day that gay rights group have dubbed a day without gays. Activists are encouraging gay rights supporters to skip work and do volunteer work instead. And the goal is to raise awareness of the role the gay community plays and to protest a recent same-sex marriage bans. And it's modelled after a similar protest by immigrant groups in 2006. Adora John.
Thank you,
Femi. Thanks, Fem.
So they were speechless in Illinois when Governor Rod Blagojevich was arrested yesterday on public corruption charges. But if you were governor, come on, you'd be tempted to sell something, right?
Good morning. This is Troy calling from North Dakota. And if I had some Blagojevich-style clout to sell anything that I want, I would get rid of the dining room table that my wife and I have unsuccessfully been trying to unload for over a year. In all fairness, it's a pretty bleeping sweet table, solid bleeping Italian walnut, and any of you bleeping guys would be lucky to have it. I bleeping dare you to buy it.
Well, thanks for sharing there, Troy.
He's
That's
making
great.
Fun of yes. you, John.
778 my take or mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
Thank
it's
you.
It's a bleeping valuable thing.
Yeah.
Thank you, Troy. We always appreciate your comments, as we do all of our listeners. Right now, we're going to move on to something far more serious, which is that today, the Bush administration's policy on post-9/11 detainees is again under scrutiny by the Supreme Court. The question this time involves a Pakistani man who claims he was subjected to abusive treatment after he was arrested in the months following September 11th. He's suing then-Attorney General John Ashcroft and former FBI Director Robert Mueller. And the test is whether the case can penetrate the immunity that government officials usually enjoy. Adam Liptak covers the Supreme Court for the New York Times and joins us from Washington. Thanks for being with us, Adam.
Hey, good morning. Thank you.
So lay out this case for us.
So after the 9/11 attacks, the government rounded up thousands of Muslim men, mostly on immigration charges, and put a number of them in a very tough detention center in Brooklyn, where they say, and the Inspector General of the Justice Department has confirmed, that they were subjected to abusive treatment, extremes of hot and cold, daily body cavity searches, isolation, some of them denied medical treatment. And one of these men has sued, and he's sued not only the people who directly contributed to what he says was his abuse, but also the guys at the very top of the pyramid, the Attorney General and the FBI Director, on the theory that they either put in place or condoned policies that, based on racial and ethnic factors, subjected people to unwarranted abuse. And the question before the Supreme Court today is how much evidence do you need at the very beginning of a lawsuit to go after the guys at the top of the pyramid?
Because the issue is really about discovery and what questions the plaintiff would be able to ask about what those leaders knew or didn't know about the way detainees were being treated, right?
Exactly right, exactly right. In every lawsuit, the sequence of events is you make some allegations. You say, here's what I think happened, here's what I say happened. And then you move into the phase of the lawsuit where you gather evidence from the other side and you try to prove out your case. The government's position is that you need to have more than just your say-so, more than just a plausible allegation at the outset. You need some proof before you even enter the courthouse door. So in a way, the question is broader and more general than what should happen to these 9/11 detainees, and really could apply to all kinds of lawsuits, which is how much do you need from the get-go in a lawsuit before you can start taking what lawyers call discovery, which is asking questions of and gathering documents from the other side.
Beyond the procedural issues that are presented by this case, what's really interesting about it is essentially, the Bush administration's policy on those detainees is being challenged on constitutional reasons.
Right. I guess there's a couple things going on here. One is that this is one of what will turn out to be many, I think, attempts to hold people accountable for what some people say were missteps and abuses after 9/11, whether in immigration detention, as in this case, or in the detention of so-called enemy combatants, as at Guantanamo, or in harsh interrogations that some people call torture in other settings. So whether by lawsuit or congressional investigation or otherwise, there will be attempts to hold people accountable, and this is one of them.
Well, Adam, I have a naive question then, maybe. What is the law on an issue where, say, a doctrine of an administration is struck down constitutionally? and maybe there were political motives of pursuing that doctrine. Is there law that allows people to sue for negligence or bad faith in some way for pursuing a doctrine they knew was possibly unconstitutional, particularly if it resulted in harm, physical or otherwise, to a plaintiff?
Well, that's not only not naive, but very well stated. Yes, if a government actor knows they were violating a clear constitutional law, the law does allow for people to hold them personally accountable for wrongs they suffered as a consequence of that. Now, there's a lot packed into that statement, and proving out that stuff is quite hard. And the government has relatively directly said, whatever the usual rules are, you got to put yourself back to September, October, November of 01 and looked at what we were up against and give us some credit for the fact that we were trying to do everything we could to keep the nation safe.
But the plaintiff's case here is really helped by that Inspector General's report that you mentioned.
For sure, and also by the fact that a second plaintiff with whom he sued in this case got a $300,000 settlement from the government. So there are strong indications that this abuse took place. Now, does that tell you that former Attorney General Ashcroft and FBI Director Mueller condoned or knew about the particular abuse or the racial and ethnic discrimination the lawsuit alleges? It doesn't quite get you there, and that's really the question before the court, is if it doesn't quite get you there today at the beginning of the lawsuit, should these guys be allowed to take discovery, to gather documents, to question, perhaps depose under oath those officials? And that's the question for the court today.
Is it possible that the outcome of this case would signal the potential exposure of someone like, say, Donald Rumsfeld to similar kinds of lawsuits?
I have a feeling the reason the Supreme Court took it, decided to hear the case, is to figure out in broad outline what sorts of procedures, if any, we'll have to allow people to try to hold high government officials accountable for post-9/11 activities.
So the court is hearing arguments today, but we're certainly not likely to see a decision until when? In the spring?
The only thing we know pretty much for sure is that the Supreme Court rules on all of the cases before it by the end of June. And this is one of a handful of the highest profile cases of the term, and those tend to be decided latest.
Adam Littack, thank you so much for joining us today.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Adam is the Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times, and he was giving us a preview of yet another challenge to the Bush administration's treatment of detainees.
For much of the hour, we've been talking about Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich and what we might sell if we were governors.
Hey, this is Rich Snow calling from Boston. And what I would be tempted as a governor to sell would be lottery tickets for sports betting.
It's a bleeping valuable thing.
Hey, you're right. If you were governor, what would tempt you? Have you ever been tempted to sell something you shouldn't? Here's your takeaway.
You know, it takes a lot to shock Illinoisans when it comes to corruption, but people were using terms like unbelievable, beyond comprehension, stunning, speechless.
And perhaps you weren't speechless. Tell us what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. I want to remind you, we're always online at thetakeaway.org.
We always want to hear from you. We think it's...
it's a bleeping valuable thing.
I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji with a co-host who loves his toys.
This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Word came early yesterday from Chicago. An Illinois U.S. Senate seat was for sale.
The conduct would make Lincoln roll over in his grave.
Lincoln rolling over in his grave? Well, 200 miles southwest of Chicago, at the burial site of our 16th president, The Takeaway's Noelle King began her investigation. The spokeswoman at Oakview Cemetery was tight-lipped.
Have you seen anything?
I'm really not going to make comment to that.
Has anyone been down there? I mean, is anyone checking it out?
I'm not going to make comment, thank you.
But at the Howard Johnson's Lodge across the street from the cemetery, the first reassuring words came from desk clerk Matt Rope.
I'm looking, and I don't see anything.
Can you see the tomb from where you are, Matt?
Relatively, yeah.
All right, and let me ask you, is the ground stirring? Is anything, is some dirt messed up, anything like that?
Yeah, I believe they're starting a Republican convention over there right now, but besides that, no, I don't see any Lincoln.
All quiet at the Lincoln tomb, a relief, but one thing's clear, Illinois politics once again digging its own grave on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, December 10th, and I can't tell you how relieved I am that all is well at Lincoln's tomb.
Lincoln's fine. Good morning, Adora.
Today we are going to take a very hard look at the case against Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich and the U.S. attorney prosecuting him. Also, we're going to take a look at politics in Ghana and South Africa, and we will note a human rights anniversary today. Those stories are coming up. First, these headlines.
One thing to watch in the Blagojevich scandal is how President-elect Barack Obama's Senate seat is filled. Democrats don't want a senator selected by a tainted governor. Dick Durbin is the other senator from Illinois, and here's his idea.
I think the Illinois General Assembly should enact a law as quickly as possible, calling for a special election to fill the Senate vacancy of Barack Obama. No appointment by this governor under these circumstances could produce a credible replacement.
Credible replacement indeed. Blagojevich is the latest in a long string of Illinois governors tainted by scandal. His predecessor went to jail.
In Washington, D.C., it appears the White House and congressional Democrats are basically on the same page for a $15 billion loan package for car makers. They hope to finalize and vote on it today, although a group of conservative senators is not convinced, so passage is far from certain. Overseas, Pakistan says it has two alleged top planners of the Mumbai attacks in custody. India has asked Pakistan to turn over high-ranking terrorist suspects, but Pakistani officials prefer to interrogate them on their own soil.
Six Afghan police are dead after a mistaken identity led to a firefight with American troops. The ensuing gunfight wounded 13. A key American ally in Iraq is pulling out. The UK has one of the largest troop presences there, but most British troops will be gone by June, according to an announcement today. The Dow was down nearly 3% yesterday, closing at 86.91. The S&P lost over 2%. It ended at 8.88, and it looks like a positive opening, at least marginally, for the Dow and Wall Street markets.
I was actually surprised. Let's go back to the Illinois governor, that the Senate seat that he apparently and allegedly was trying to sell was going for $500,000.
$500,000,
that's cheap.
Come on, you can do better than that. 877-8-MY-TAKE. What is a Senate seat worth? What would you sell? Is it worth more than Illinois than in New York or Alaska? What would you be willing to pay for a Senate seat? What would you sell if you were a governor with superpowers? 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. We've actually been getting some pretty interesting responses on this one.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I am a citizen of Illinois, and I do have opinions and beliefs. And what they are for me, because when I speak on behalf of that seal, and that seal has no opinion on that matter.
The man leading the case against Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich has a reputation for hard-charging, no-nonsense prosecutions against politicians in both parties. U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald prosecuted former Bush White House aide Scooter Libby in the CIA leak investigation of the Valerie Plame case. He's prosecuted Illinois state Democrats and Republicans alike for corruption, including Republican Governor Ryan, who is currently in prison. What does his reputation say about his latest controversial case? Well, for that, we turn to Scott Shane, a New York Times reporter who has recently updated his file on Fitzgerald. Good morning and welcome, Scott.
Good morning.
How would you describe Prosecutor Fitzgerald?
He's a very sort of straight-ahead, very meticulous, very tough prosecutor. He's the kind of guy who, if you've done something, you're ashamed of. You really don't want him, you know, looking around into what you've been up to.
Some say that at least one of the criticisms about him has been that often he's too zealously goes after journalists, like, say, he did in the case of Scooter Libby. There were many journalists who, well, there were at least two who ended up spending time in prison for refusing to answer his questions.
Well, yeah, I think some people might say he is a little bit lacking in nuance. A lot of prosecutors are also politicians. Many of them have political ambitions, especially at his level. He's the U.S. attorney in Chicago. Some U.S. attorneys in Chicago have gone on to be governor, take other political posts. And guys like that are sort of, you know, doing a little bit of a balancing act. People say that he has a very clear sense of right and wrong, and he's sort of a guided missile. You point him towards a target, and he goes after it. And that might also be might apply to the CIA leak investigation, where no one was ultimately prosecuted for actually violating the law by revealing the name of an undercover agent, which was the original crime he was investigating. Scooter Libby was Vice President Cheney's chief of staff, and he was prosecuted for lying to the FBI and lying to the grand jury about it. So it was a cover-up situation. And the reporters, especially Judith Miller, then my colleague at the New York Times, who went to prison, went to jail, rather, for declining to name her sources, I think he saw her as collateral damage. She wouldn't testify in his case, and that was all he needed to know.
So based on what you know about him and his reputation, what does that say to you about this current case against the governor of Illinois?
Well, he spoke yesterday with a kind of appalled relish, is what I called it in the paper today. He seemed to want to share some of the more outrageous stories in the indictment, and the indictment makes incredible reading for those who have a little time to kill today and haven't seen it yet.
It's only 76 pages.
Only 76 pages, but it reads like a novel.
Yep.
It does.
But he also, though, I think wanted to get a lot of that detail out, because sometimes in political cases where you're indicting a major politician, there is always the possible interpretation that this is somehow partisan, that this is some kind of, you know, Chicago political skullduggery. And by putting an unusual amount of detail in the indictment, including long excerpts from wiretaps, you know, I think he wanted to make it clear, and also giving a very long press conference, he wanted to make it clear
which
that
I noted,
he has evidence.
Because this is not a man of many words to the press, and certainly not someone who speaks in detail about his cases before he tries them.
Yeah, but again, I think he wanted to sort of say this is not a political prosecution, even though it's a prosecution of a politician. Here is why we're indicting this guy. The other thing he said was that they rushed it. He had acknowledged that they sort of rushed it because there were a number of crimes in progress, essentially, that he was accusing Governor Blagojevich of, including selling the Senate seat that's been vacated by Barack Obama.
Well, you know, I wonder if he did rush, I guess we'll see in court how much of the wiretap stands up and what sort of material evidence there is of the other crimes. In your article, Scott, the thing that amazed me, though, is that Patrick Fitzgerald has no life. I mean, he has a messy desk full of socks and has never been married and apparently does nothing other than these cases.
Actually, that information is a little outmoded. When I wrote about him in 2005, that was the case, and people talked about how he, in big terrorism trials and mob trials in New York, he had literally slept in his office, and people would go through his desk looking for something, and they'd find old socks. But he actually, this year, to the surprise of some of his friends, he married a woman who's a former investment banker and a Head Start teacher in Chicago. So he's now married. I'm told that his home is is far neater and that he's actually taking occasional time away from the office.
There's a couple of weddings in that team. The assistant district attorney got married in October as well, who's on the team, who did the Resco investigation as well. It's a happy group.
I guess corruption investigations lead to love.
Lead to love. Well, there's our takeaway. Scott Shane, a great pleasure, and we'll look forward to having you back.
Thanks for having me.
Scott Shane, a New York Times reporter, with his latest update on a profile of U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald.
Appalled relish. That's my takeaway. Joining us now is Cynthia Canary, who's executive director of the Illinois Campaign for Political Reform. And Cynthia, you're on the line from Chicago, sort of ground zero of all of this.
In
the pantheon of corruption in Illinois politics down through history, where does this stand?
I have to say that this is at the peak of the mountain. At least I hope it's at the peak. We've seen a lot of indictments come down over the last couple of years. Our previous governor's in jail. And, I consider myself somewhat hardened reading these things. And my jaw dropped when I read this criminal complaint yesterday. It's really one of the most appalling documents I've ever read, particularly, when you consider the fact that Governor Blagojevich is allegedly, fully in action right through last weekend in trying to, negotiate the sale of the Senate seat and make plans with his own political fund. It is a really shocking piece of work.
Well, Cynthia, is he out of character of traditional corrupt politicians in Illinois? Is there something he's done that's really radically different, or is it just more extreme? And it seems that he attracted your attention because he's such a fantastic fundraiser.
Well, that's a very good question. I think that he definitely is more extreme. He's a fundraiser, par excellence. I don't think we've ever seen anyone like him. But he is also a different kind of character in Chicago and in Illinois. Traditionally, when you look at corruption here, you look at cronyism. You look at, somebody who is consolidating power, who's handing out jobs, and you look at kind of a scheme that is the underlying kind of value, would be loyalty. You're looking at somebody who's building a network. With Blagojevich, there is no loyalty. This is about Rod Blagojevich and no one else. So this is not the same old boys network we've seen before. This is not machine politics. This is one man out to enrich himself.
So that would tend to, I guess not exonerate, but lead investigators and advocates such as yourself away from, say, Rahm Emanuel, who actually did until he was named chief of staff of the Obama transition team, the congressional seat that was once held by Rod Blagojevich.
Right. This is a very different kind of scheme. I mean, when you look at this criminal complaint, which I agree is excellent reading, when you look at it and you listen to what Rod, or you hear what Rod has to say about the Senate seat, this is something bleep bleep valuable. This is mine. I can decide who gets it. This is a man who's thinking only of himself and what he can pocket.
And has watched way too many movies, it seems, just by the way he talks.
And really fancies Elvis a little bit too much.
I think so. Well, he does have that fantastic hair, which apparently...
Oh, that hair, we're thinking if, in fact, he is convicted, perhaps they'll give him a haircut.
Cynthia Canary, Executive Director of the Illinois Campaign for Political Reform, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So... $500,000 seems to be petty cash for a Senate seat. What would you come up with? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. So imagine you're Governor Rod Blagojevich. Okay, you've got a lot of stuff.
It's a bleeping valuable thing.
And what would you sell as governor?
Hey, guys, at The Takeaway, this is Ethan in Williamsburg. I just want you to know I am selling the Brooklyn Borough presidency to the highest bidder. This offer expires at noon today.
Nice. How much is a Senate seat worth, the borough presidency? If you were a governor, what would you sell? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Joining us now is Martin Plowd, a BBC Africa editor and our pal here at The Takeaway. Martin is joining us to talk about some developments on the continent of Africa, specifically two countries. Good morning, Martin.
Hi, Adora. How are you?
Let's talk about this very close presidential race in Ghana, which has really been a beacon for the last 20 years or so for a peaceful transition of power in government.
Indeed, it's been an extraordinary example to the rest of Africa, which of course is living through a situation where you've had both in Kenya and Zimbabwe terrible examples after elections were fought. But the Commonwealth Observer Group were there, just talked about how well it went despite the quite challenging circumstances. So it's been really an excellent election and a model to the whole continent so far.
And it's very close and perhaps could lead to a runoff. But there sounds like from the reporting that there are some real tensions about this race.
There are some tensions, but, so far they've been managed very well. It was extraordinary that my colleagues who were at the International Press Center tell me that the press actually excluded the main candidates from the center after they'd made what they considered were two strong statements, which is an extraordinary turnaround for the press to take. But yes, indeed, things are looking very tight. The one thing that now looks as if there might be a runoff in a second round in the presidential elections, which would take place on the 27th or 28th of December, and you might even have a situation where the opposition wins the parliament, but the ruling party at the moment with Nana Akufo-Addo becomes the president. You then would have a bit of a split, so that could be difficult.
Well, there's democracy at work for you, which brings
us now
to South Africa and really the aftermath of a split in the African National Congress after the ouster of former President Thabo Mbeki. Tell us the latest stresses.
Well, what's happened is that a party broke away from the ANC. This is called COPE, the Congress of the People. I went to their inaugural meeting, and they've now are fighting the first seats. These are just local government seats, but it's the first indication of what kind of support they're going to get. These are mostly in the Western Cape. They're very fiercely contested. Unfortunately, the ruling African National Congress didn't manage to get their nominations in on time in 12 seats, so that's been a bit of a problem for them. They've had to actually pull out of those particular races, but in other areas there is really a race on the go. So we'll have to see. We don't at this stage know how it's going. There have been some intimidation apparently by the ANC members against the opposition according to the Election Commission, but that's about where we are on that one.
And aren't they charging that the Congress of the People don't have a right to use that name?
Well, that's right, because, of course, it's the African National Congress, and it was the Congress of the People which met and drew up the Freedom Charter all those years ago, which is the founding document, which begins so famously, South Africa belongs to all who live in her, black and white. This was, said, I think it was in the 50s. It was an extraordinarily strong statement, and everybody wants to sort of latch on to the legitimacy of that because it's part of the liberation struggle. If I may just say one other thing in Africa that's happened today is that Sheikh Sharif, the opposition leader in Somalia, has also arrived in Mogadishu. We've literally just learnt that. So that's quite a breaking story because
there's,
it could change
there's
the
leaders,
situation.
Martin, in Somalia? I'm confused.
Well, you're right. I mean, what sort of leaders? But he was the opposition leader who was based in Eritrea. He's a member of the Islamist group. You remember the Islamic courts that were thrown out by the Ethiopians?
Mm-hmm.
He's now come back to Mogadishu, to the capital, and say that that's really quite a breaking story. How is that going to be responded to by, the other Islamists, some of whom haven't gone in and are still attacking the Ethiopians, but he seems to have come over to the other side. It's quite a change.
Well, quickly, Martin, does that suggest gains for the radicals in Somalia, or maybe consolidation of more moderate forces in that very, as you alluded to, chaotic country?
You know, you can read it any way, which way you like. There are some towns in which I believe there are three different Islamist groups now in control, some of them now fighting each other. If you can make sense of that, you're a better man than I.
And what's the level of foreigners in Somalia at this point and their role in those variety of groups that you just mentioned?
Well, the foreigners are involved in many different ways. I mean, for example, the Eritreans are reported to be backing the Islamists. On the other hand, the transitional federal government, which has the support of the United Nations and the African Union, is supported by the Ethiopian troops who are in the country but say that they will leave by the end of December. And you then have an African Union force of Rwandans and Ugandans who are also supporting the transitional force, but they're looking in an increasingly perilous position. It's a mess, to put it bluntly.
Martin, what's your two cents on the pirates off the coast of East Africa?
Well, they up and running. They're a thriving industry. They just grab a ship a day, more or less, and park it away and demand a couple of million dollars for its release. They're doing extremely well. Now, there's been a recent development. Has been that the European Union is now trying to send a force down there to work with the Indian forces, the American forces, who are all trying to stop them. But so far, it's pirates one, the rest of the world zero.
Martin Plaut, always a pleasure, sir.
Okay, speak to you soon.
Martin Plaut is the BBC or a BBC Africa editor and our pal here at The Takeaway.
And those pirates have all that fabulous beachfront property there in Mogadishu.
What do you say? Pirates won, the international world zero. Well, we're going to turn over to Femi Okeh, who's got the headlines.
Thank you. Just coming up to 29 minutes past the hour. Even after his arrest, Illinois Governor Rob Blagojevich could still pick the next Illinois senator. State lawmakers and Senate Democrats don't want that to happen. They're trying to change the law so voters can choose the next senator by special election. Most British troops will be out of Iraq by next June. The pullouts will start in March. The UK has about 4,000 troops in southern Iraq. And at the height of the invasion in 2003, there were about 40,000 British troops fighting in the country. Most of the troops will be redeployed to Afghanistan. A new sign that China's powerhouse economy is feeling the strain of the economic slowdown. China's reporting a drop in exports for the first time in 7 years. And as foreign demand has dropped, layoffs and factory closings have spread across China. And New Jersey has civil unions, but a state commission urges lawmakers to allow gay couples to marry. A new report says that civil unions do not provide same-sex couples with the same protections as married heterosexuals. And that's a look at stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Our takeaway question today has been inspired by Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich, or at least the allegations against him. If you were a politician, what do you think you'd put up for sale?
I would sell the naming rights to military operations so that on our next foreign endeavor, the CNN would have to say, as opposed to this is Operation Iranian Freedom, this is Operation Ford Motor Company.
Operation AIG, AIG Operation Iraqi Freedom. That's great.
I don't know if Ford or even AIG could afford that about now, but we'd like to hear your story. What would you be tempted to sell if you were in a position of power? Maybe not even necessarily just a politician, but maybe a CEO or so on. Give us your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
Well, speaking of Ford Motor Company, in all these Blagojevich allegations, we've lost the sense that they're still ironing out that emergency government loan package for struggling U.S. automakers. Joining us now is Todd Zwillick from Capital News Connection, who's watching the negotiations as they continue. We may get a deal today. We may also hear from some Republican opponents who may try to derail the bill. Todd, thanks for being with us.
Hi, good morning.
First of all, what are the, are the details still as they were yesterday when we were talking to you? We're talking car czar, $15 billion in loans. There's the issue of lawsuits that the car companies want dropped, but some in Congress don't.
Right. So all of those details you just mentioned are the same. Those were the broad details, the framework that everybody said they had agreement on. But some of the finer details appear to have changed. There was a provision that was a sticking point early on that said that the car czar would have control over any transaction of $25 million or more, that the big three would have to get permission, essentially, to execute any transaction above $25 million. That number apparently has been raised to $100 million, which was a concession to Republicans. The big three raised the point, and some of their proxies raised the point that in the world of the auto manufacturers, $25 million is a pittance, so it doesn't go very far. So that's been raised to $100 million. There's a question of there's a still outstanding question of the holding company that controls Chrysler and how quickly and how closely they'll have to repay their loans. That remains
Cerberus,
a sticking point.
The Cerberus company, right, that owns Chrysler.
Yeah. And also one last thing, the issue of lawsuits, the issue of state EPA waiver carbon lawsuits, these are global warming lawsuits essentially, that remains a sticking point. That's still in the bill. It may be dropped by the time it reaches the floor or even the amendment process. But Democrats so far have refused to drop that because don't forget, they sort of made an environmental concession at the outset by allowing this money to come from an account that was supposed to help plants and companies build more fuel-efficient and environmentally friendly products. So
now, some Republicans are supposed to go before the cameras today and announce their opposition to either some aspect of this bailout or the whole package itself. Is the real headline there that Republicans are projecting that Democrats don't have 60 votes on this and so they can shut it down at any time?
Well, it is very unclear if there are 60 votes around an approach in the Senate. What they can do for sure is delay it. So there's absolutely no question about that. You're talking about a group led by Senator John Ensign from Nevada. There are some other conservatives in that group who don't like this deal for varying reasons. They will, if they object, and it appears that they will, depending on the final language, they will have the ability to slow this down by as much as a week, by the way. Mm-hmm. If they use all of the levers and buttons available to them under Senate procedure, they can slow this way down. Whether or not they choose to kill it is their choice, and it depends on what kind of concessions they extract.
And the way GM and Chrysler are spending, a week equals billions of dollars.
It might, yeah.
Right. I noticed you used the word car czar there. You didn't really like that word yesterday, and when you suggested that listeners come up with a new one, our phone started ringing off the hook, Todd.
Oh, yeah. Well, I saw there were lots and lots of suggestions. There was, you know, that there were quite a few floating around Capitol Hill as well, John, that you may not have heard amongst reporters and staff and even police and anyone else who's hanging around the halls of Congress. There's some good ones. So, of course, you got autocrat, which is a favorite of mine.
That's good.
Motor General was a great one.
I love that. That's like my favorite.
Okay. Well, how about Lemonhead?
That's good. There's a band.
It
Lemonhead.
Took me a minute. I get
that.
It. Now.
That's good. Yeah.
Lemonhead.
Okay. Okay.
The barber of Detroit. Everyone gets a haircut.
Oh, that's from the Pelosi line yesterday.
Oh,
yeah, yeah.
Todd,
that's all right.
You're not. That's you right. Can do better. I know you can.
All right, I've got one. This one is mine. The Lone Ranger in Dodge City.
The Lone Ranger.
The Lone Ranger.
That's good.
Dodge
yeah, a little
City.
Too much time, free time on your hands there, Todd.
Here's a little
one of
too
our.
Much.
Here's one of our listeners.
How about Megatron and the rest of the cabinet could be the Decepticons.
Transformers.
Decepticons.
There was an Optimus Prime yesterday, wasn't there?
That's right. Well, it's all from the Transformers. Yeah. And at the very least, these car companies are going to be transformed by this bailout plan on the Hill. Hugh in Manhattan had this idea, Todd. SUV Supreme Uber Viceroy.
And oh, I was trying to come up with something on SUV, and I couldn't think of anything. I love it.
It still leaves us with the same problem. I'm not sure what a czar does, and I'm not sure what a viceroy does either.
Yeah, well, let's leave. What will the czar do based on the latest details, and then we got to go?
Well, a lot more control, actually, than was originally in the plan. In the original plan, the czar would have the option to kill these loans if the companies didn't come back with good, solid, long-ranging viability plans by March 31st. That has now apparently changed in a concession to Republicans. The viceroy or the czar will now have the option to kill those loans – not the option, the requirement, pardon me, to kill those loans entirely. If the plans are no good, if the viability is not long-ranging and doesn't make sense to the czar and to the administration and to the Congress, kill the loans. Recall them.
Todd Zwillick, he's our transformer. More than meets the eye there. Capital News Connection. Thanks, Todd. And now headlines from Femi Okay.
The time is just coming up to 20 minutes to the top of the hour. There's more violence between police and protesters in Greece today. Two police officers faced charges in the shooting death of a teenager that sparked the country's worst rioting in decades. One is charged with murder. The lawyer for the cop says that the boy died from a ricochet shot. He claims this backs up the police story that they fired warning shots. One of Yahoo's largest shareholders is urging the company to sell. The investment firm Ivory wants Yahoo to sell its search engine to Microsoft for $15 billion. Talks about a total buyout by Microsoft fell apart this summer. And in other business news, Office Depot is cutting costs. It will close more than 100 stores. It's also sharply reducing the new store openings next year. Congress is looking into the $700 billion rescue package. A new House Financial Services Committee report says that the Bush administration asked the Bush administration why the money isn't helping homeowners. The program has come under fire on the Hill before. Last week, a Government Accountability Office audit criticized the lack of oversight. The Italian government is conducting its own bailout. They are going to buy hundreds of thousands of wheels of cheese to help the troubled dairy industry. The bailout will cost Italy about $65 million and the cheese will be donated to charity. It also includes Parmesan cheese because the cheese industry in Italy is suffering at the moment.
So that would be charity cheese?
Yes.
Charity cheese?
How can the Parmesan cheese industry be suffering?
Well, there's connections. Do you remember the big garbage strike in Naples last year? There were all sort of rumblings and connections between that strike and then the production of cheese, and so it goes
got
on.
Got it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Huh.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. 60 years ago today, the world made a declaration that began with these words: whereas recognition of the inherent dignity and of the equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family is the foundation of freedom, justice, and peace in the world. You may be unfamiliar with the 1,772 words that make up the most translated document in world history, but there are people all around the world who can recite it by heart. The General Assembly proclaims this Universal Declaration of Human Rights as a common standard of achievement for all peoples and all nations.
For the first time, the international community of nations has considered and declared what, in its opinion, are those human rights and fundamental freedoms which every human being, without exception, is entitled to enjoy.
That's H.V. Evatt, president of the U.N. General Assembly back in 1948, describing a document as emblematic as the U.S. Declaration of Independence or an even older Declaration of Freedom.
This Universal Declaration of Human Rights may well become the international Magna Carta of all men everywhere.
First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt championed the Declaration as a Magna Carta answer to the brutality of the just-ended World War. And over the past six decades, world leaders of all kinds have used it to fight tyranny or even to deflect criticism of their own internal tyranny.
He has very little to lecture us on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. His hands drip with innocent blood of many nationalities.
Because they supported basic commitments that are also guaranteed in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which the Soviet Union and other members of the United Nations have publicly and officially endorsed.
This is a human right which was defined by the Universal Declaration
of Human Rights, which came out of the United Nations way back in 1948.
This declaration is based upon the spiritual fact that man must have freedom in which to develop his full stature.
And there were a few statures represented there: Zimbabwe's dictator Robert Mugabe, anti-Soviet U.S. President Jimmy Carter, Gary Davis there, a self-styled believer in one world government. The declaration is a means to their various political ends. But in 1979, Pope John Paul II reminded the world of the terrible price it had paid for this document. So simple, so controversial.
This declaration was paid for by millions of our brothers and sisters at the cost of their suffering and sacrifice. This price cannot have been paid in vain.
Perhaps so-called self-evident rights and truths run the risk of slipping away unless we openly declare them, repeat them again and again in a world with such a terrible legacy of forgetting.
The Declaration sets a standard, an objective, for that it is not legally binding. It is therefore essential for this Assembly to take subsequent steps to ensure that the rights which we have declared are in fact implemented, so that human rights and fundamental freedoms shall not merely be recognized, but also put into practical effect.
The Declaration is still debated, is enforced by international peacekeepers in some places, but even today it is hardly universal. Its 1,772 words must be whispered by those who can only dream they will someday come true for them. Happy birthday, Declaration.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning on this Wednesday, December 10th. We have the latest headlines for you from Femi Okeh.
Thank you very much. Good morning. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Just looking at the markets, how they're doing. Wall Street's been open for just over 20 minutes or so. S&P was up 8 points, Dow up 92 points. European markets have been mixed today, and this comes after a strong day for Asian markets. U.S. Special Forces have accidentally killed 6 Afghan police officers and wounded at least 13 others. Officials say the police fired on the Americans, mistaking them for Taliban fighters. Lawmakers in Washington could vote on a package for the struggling auto industry as early as today. Congressional Democrats and the White House have agreed in principle to the $15 billion loan package, but Republican skepticism means the bill faces a tough challenge. A new sign that China's powerhouse economy is feeling the strain of the economic slowdown. China is reporting a drop in exports for the first time in 7 years. As foreign demand has dropped, layoffs and factory closings have spread across the country. German astronomers say that they've confirmed that there's definitely, without a shadow of a doubt, a black hole at the center of our galaxy. Black holes are objects so dense that nothing can escape their gravity, not even light. And scientists spent 16 years studying the stars circling the center of the Milky Way. And Dr. Hendrik Barktow said that when he worked on the study, that the black hole is an essential part of our galaxy.
It holds the galaxy together and also dominates the evolution of galaxies. So it's very important for us that we have such a black hole.
Easy for him to say.
And if you want to read more about the study, it's published in Astrophysical Journal this month.
I wonder how easy that is to read.
I broke it down for you.
But thank you very much.
In about 20 seconds.
Full black hole coverage from Femi Okeh. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
Today we've been inspired for our takeaway question by Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich, who's being accused of putting up a Barack Obama's former Senate seat up for sale.
This is Kelly from Jersey City. One thing we can't sell anymore is the fantastic American image. It doesn't exist.
So we're asking you, what would you sell if you were in a position of power? Say you're a CEO or a governor, what would you put on the selling block? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
We're not encouraging you to do that, actually. People on our website are actually thinking that we're trying to bring down, you know, life as we know it on the planet by encouraging corruption, but we're actually not doing that.
No, we're not. We are... What are we doing then? I'm just kidding. No. Right now, we're going to move on to more serious issues about the case. And that is that even in a state like Illinois, where its last governor is currently in prison after being convicted of corruption charges, the latest allegations against the governor has been a bit shocking. And we want to take a look at the allegations and the case that the U.S. prosecutor outlined in its complaint. So we're joined now by Chicago lawyer Pat Deedy to help figure us out, to help us figure it all out. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning.
So what was your first impression after you read the 76-page complaint? There you are in Chicago, a Chicago lawyer, very well acquainted with what goes on in the political circles there, and you read this.
Well, I got to tell you, yesterday morning, I got up and on the way to the office, saw that he'd been arrested and got a copy of the 78 pages and went through it. And we're no strangers to corruption here in Chicago. And as lawyers, you know, I've been a lawyer for 30 years now and seen this will be the fourth governor indicted in my lifetime. So, but the kind of the scope and the breadth of the charges, I think, surprised everybody in town. Nobody was going to be surprised that he was going to get indicted.
Right.
It's been a talk of, in the newspapers. There's been speculation during the several very public trials, including the one last summer, where, there was some fairly graphic testimony about, somebody being in the presence of the governor, putting down a $25,000 campaign check and being promised a position on one of the state boards. I mean, that was graphic testimony in the case of Tony Resco. And everybody assumed at some point in time in the not-too-distant future there would be some historical indictment about all this pay-for-play corruption that has been swirling around Springfield and Chicago since 2002 when the governor was first elected. But to see what happened since October and to see the fact that you have a federal judge approving wiretaps on his personal phone.
Not once, but twice.
Well, that's the amazing thing. Wouldn't you have loved to have seen the face of the judge when Patrick Fitzgerald went in and said, look, guys, we think he's going to sell the Senate seat. And that judge had to figure out whether to approve the wiretaps.
Well, I think that's a misnomer. I think that they knew that he was engaged in this practice. There's going to be change in the law in Illinois in January, and so they were currently investigating, in terms of limiting campaign contributions. And the investigation had turned to the fact that in the last 6 months of 2008, there was all this pressure among Blagojevich and his campaign funds to generate some more cash from their normal donors, who are primarily state contractors or other people that.
And that's the allegation.
Right.
That he was working much faster to try to raise as much money as he could.
And they had, I think, gotten the cooperation of a key player in that fundraising effort. And that's, I think, what led to the initial bugging of his campaign offices and the wiretapping of his phones. I have to say that, at least from the reaction at the press conference yesterday, most of even the FBI agents who have been doing this for a long time, and some of whom I know, I think they were amazed and stunned and, I think, disgusted when it got to the point where it was just so blatant. I don't think they expected to have the kind of evidence. Nobody expected, and when they turned the wiretap on in late October, that the Senate seat of, Illinois was going to be up for grabs and up for sale.
What's really interesting to me about the complaint is the amount of detail. And you're not just talking about allegations of one person who supposedly witnessed this quid pro quo, but a series over several years, and then including the alleged offering of the Senate seat.
Well, some of those, the complaint lays out essentially a summary of the trial of Tony Resco, which was kind of a compendium of a number of different allegations involving fundraising. And then there've been subsequent indictments of other players in Springfield with respect to that since the Resco conviction. And there was always speculation that there were additional people that had been approached and cooperated, and there was something not too long ago suggesting that that people, should start to come forward, and obviously some people did. But in the last, I think the the most striking part of the complaint is the last 20 pages that talk about all the activities that have been done since October.
Right. And I guess, you know, the amateur sport there in Chicago this morning is trying to figure out all the other names that might be on the phone conversations that weren't disclosed in the complaint.
Well, I think that's been the, you know, the discussion and topic of blogs all over the place is who's Senate candidate 3, 4, 5, 6, you know, those people. I mean, there, some people are quickly identified because of the outside references, but there were a lot of very prominent politicians who actively were, and most people thought legitimately seeking to be considered as candidates, and to have, you know, and at least several have already come out and said publicly that, you know, I was interested in it. I never did anything that's been alleged here. I think Danny Davis was on the news last night. He was, you know, he had, I think, met with the governor, and he's somebody that had, I don't know if he's specifically named or identified in the complaint, but he, but there are a series of people, you know, that were.
And so
that,
there's a lot of people this morning holding their breath, I would guess. But just very quickly, your final thought, when you read the complaint, are there weaknesses in the case that jump out at you immediately?
Well,
or do you just feel like the U.S. attorney laid out a very strong case against the governor?
I really think this is the tip of the iceberg. They haven't talked to anybody else. You know, the wiretap gives you a very slender sliver of the conversations, and you don't get them all. They're out fanning right now. People are being talked to and subpoenaed, I'm sure. And every criminal defense lawyer in Chicago has been called. I've been called already about cases. So, I mean, you know, people are concerned and people are going to be approached. And you know, the FBI's got 30 to 60 days to return an indictment, and depending on how much time the judge gives them. But this is really the beginning, not the end.
What if you're representing the governor? What advice do you give at this point facing this?
I think you have to look hard at what it's going to take to defend this case and whether or not you can do that and effectively represent the people of Illinois.
Is Dan Webb going to take that case? Is Dan Webb going to take that case, former U.S. attorney?
He has a different lawyer that was hired. I think Winston Strawn, Dan Webb's firm, represented him briefly during the course of the investigation, and my understanding was that there was a parting of the ways some time ago, and now another attorney in town has been representing him, you know, at least for now. I don't know if he's going to choose additional counsel or not.
Pat Dede, we can't thank you enough for joining us this morning and helping us to understand what's happening there in Illinois.
Glad to be on.
Pat Dede is a lawyer with the firm Hogan Marin, based in Chicago. He's head of the litigation practice.
Which, of course, raises the question, what if we were politicians?
I think if I were president, I would sell naming rights to various buildings. For example, we could have the Bank America White House. There's all kinds of great possibilities.
What do you think? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
It's a bleeping valuable thing.